Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila, and Leo will be with us in a minute. And today is Wednesday, and on Wednesdays we usually do union issues and news and articles from the AFL-CIO website and from AFSCME. So tonight we're going to start with an article from the AFL-CIO website. It's by Kenneth Quinnell. Oh, and here's Leo. Leo, say hi to folks. And this is 350 economists reject austerity measures. A group of 350 prominent economists, including economic experts from the AFL-CIO, issued a joint statement warning that the type of austerity measures favored by Republicans and suggested by the bipartisan commission led by Erskine Bowles and Ellen Simpson would further harm the economy and weaken the social safety net that millions of working families rely on. They argue that the seemingly obsessive focus on the deficit obscures what the country really needs to focus on, and that's creating jobs. The economists base their position not just on theory, but on the real-world examples of European countries that have pursued austerity measures. As Great Britain, Ireland, Spain, and Greece have shown, inflicting austerity on a weak economy leads to a deeper recession, rising unemployment, and increasing misery. Teresa Gil-Arducci, director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School, says that the debt burden is not nearly as important as the high unemployment rate. She adds that the additional fiscal stimulus, mostly focused on spending increases, would better help the economy recover. She supports increases in emergency unemployment insurance, helping state and local governments to prevent layoffs, helping state and local governments fix roads, energy, and water infrastructure, and increasing spending on education. Government spending during times of low inflation and high rates of unemployment pay for itself. Spending now creates demand so that the private sector has a reason to produce. These types of measures would do much to increase jobs and bring down the unemployment number, and that change would translate into decreased deficits. The statement makes other suggestions for spending increases that would boost the economy. The government should invest in areas vital to our economy, to repair crumbling infrastructure, to build 21st century smart grid public transportation and renewable energy systems, and to create public and private sector jobs. We should also help states prevent layoffs of teachers and other public servants, make early care and higher education more affordable, and create public service jobs throughout the nation. It could do so by borrowing at a record low interest rate, where we can also stimulate recovery without increasing deficits by increasing taxes on the wealthy and pumping the proceeds directly into the economy. Robert Bourassage, co-author of the statement, along with his co-director of the Institute for America's Future, Roger Hickey, and Robert Kuttner, founder of the American Prospect, say that the voters told Congress and the President the same thing these economists are saying, that they don't want the deficit cut if it means cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And that's that. That was a pretty good article.
Okay. And there's another one up there that I wanted to cover tonight. No, if you look at what's happening across the country, if you look across Europe, you find a tremendous number of riots going on.
And high misery.
Greece, everywhere, but Spain. for a national walkout for tomorrow.
Oh, really?
The 14th, I believe, like
protesting
today.
The austerity measure.
Yeah, and they're going crazy over there, and for good reason. And I think it's they're going nuts over there. And
really?
Yeah. It's kind of it's a critical thing because.
Where did you see that, Leo? So they're all walking out of their jobs?
They're walking off for
a protest.
Yeah, for the day. For one day.
They have an extraordinarily high unemployment rate, too.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised at this. I wasn't surprised at this one. I'll read in a minute. Ergonomic injuries account for a growing share of workplace injuries. I was really surprised at that because...
What are ergonomic injuries?
Musculoskeletal disorders.
From hunching over a computer,
that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Not sure. Well, and you get carpal tunnel, and
yeah.
If you're at a computer a long time.
Yeah. It's not a good thing, right?
No.
There's so many related...
I'm on the computer a lot, but nothing like a secretary or... someone who's data processing all the time.
In 2011, musculoskeletal disorders that forced workers to miss at least one day on a job accounted for one-third of all workplace injuries that required time off from work. That's up from 29% in 2010. According to recent figures from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. It is unclear, says BLS, if the increases reported musculoskeletal disorders injuries in the result of more workers getting hurt on the job or a change from 2010 in the way that injuries are classified. However, many workplace safety advocates, MSD injuries, caused by repetitive motion, lifting, or other workplace activities are the major cause of serious workers' injuries. Yeah. AFL-CIO Safety and Health Director Faith Seminaro reminds us that since the Bush administration and the Republican Congress in 2001 repealed the Occupational Safety and Health Administration ergonomic rule that specifically addressed MSDs, and the workplace practice that causes such injuries, no OSHA standard protects workers from ergonomic injuries. Freaking Bush. Not only did he kill the Todd Demme economy, he's killing everybody in the workplace.
He's never had to have a job.
What a piece of shit he is. The MSD statistics are from the BLS Non-Fatal Occupational Injuries and Illnesses Requiring Days Away from Work 2011 report. The report found six occupations accounted for 26% of the MSD cases in 2011.
What were those?
Nursing assistants, laborers, janitors and cleaners, heavy and tractor, trailer, truck drivers, registered nurses, and stock clerks.
Nurses, probably because they're lifting patients.
Nurses and nurse assistants.
Yeah, they really get beaten up that way. They didn't say anything about secretaries and people working at computers.
I'm surprised.
I
would think that would be a
big one, but I guess it's not.
Yeah. Not as much as the others.
Yeah. That's a surprise to me.
Yeah. This one I wanted to read tonight. It's called Fix the Debt, a Trojan Horse for Corporate Tax Cuts. It's so typical, Maybe you've read it, the CEO campaign for Fix the Debt, which did a $60 million war chest and the blessings of more than 80 CEOs of America's biggest corporations. Fix the Debt is passing itself off as a reasoned call for compromise to save the nations from economic disaster. But as this new infographic and recent studies show, the companies behind Fix the Debt stand plan to gain $134 billion from one of the tax breaks they are promoting. Not just any tax breaks, mind you, but a new tax incentive for corporations to send U.S. jobs overseas. A new report from the Institute of Policy Studies warns that a Trojan horse, fix the debt is a Trojan horse concealing massive corporate tax breaks that would make our debt situation much worse. Peel away the slick PR and here's what fix the debt really is. A powerful corporate lobby using the deficit as an excuse to sneak through costly corporate tax breaks, while at the same time cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. According to the IPS study, the 63 fix the debt companies that are publicly held stand to gain as much as $134 million in windfalls if Congress approves one of their main proposals, a territorial tax system. Under this system, companies would not have to pay U.S. federal taxes on foreign earnings when they bring the profits back to the United States. Screw that.
Well, that's not right.
No. And the CEO back, they should be paying for it in other countries as well if they're doing business in the United States. CEO back and fixed the debt personally received a combined total of $41 million in savings last year thanks to the Bush-era tax cuts. The top CEO beneficiary of the Bush tax cuts in 2011, Leon Black of Apollo Global Management, saved $9.9 million on the Bush tax cuts. The private equity fund leader reaped $215 million in taxable income last year just from invested stock. And of the 63 fix-the-debt CEOs at public health firms, 24 received more in compensation last year than their corporations paid in federal corporate income taxes.
Oh, my God.
But all but six of these firms reported U.S. profits last year. Don't let corporate CEOs and lobbyists preaching from a grand bargain dominate the debate in Washington. Sign this petition to tell Congress that it's time to let the Bush tax cuts for the richest 2% expire and that they must reject any Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefit cuts.
Well, we've got to sign that.
Yeah. So, it's really important. So if you go to the AFL-CIO blog and look up that, it's right there on their site.
So you need to do that, folks. That's really important.
Yeah.
Otherwise, those tax cuts for the wealthy will continue and your taxes will go up.
That's right. They will not change. It's really staggering what they continue to allow. They step on you no matter what the hell you do. This is interesting. So if anybody's planning to go, anyone's planning to go to Walmart on Black Friday, they may not have any people working there.
California Walmart warehouse workers strike. Others ready for Black Friday action. Walmart warehouse workers in Mira Loma, California, launched a strike Wednesday morning to protest management retaliation against the workers over their September strike, speaking out about unsafe working conditions. Meanwhile, Walmart store workers around the country are making plans to spotlight Walmart's abuse with a Black Friday Thursday walkout. The workers at the Mira Loma warehouse are employed by a Walmart subcontractor, Warestaff, but worker leader Raymond Castillo told The Nation's Josh Edelson, because Walmart is the beneficiary of all his work and the boss of his boss's boss, the unsafe conditions the workers say they face are Walmart's fault, he writes. Castillo said he expects that some retail workers will join his co-workers' strike Thursday, making it the latest case of joint action at multiple points in Walmart's supply chain. He described the coming strike as part of the progression toward Black Friday. We were the ones that started it. Now they want to kick it off with us starting it again, making it a big old trend. In October, Walmart workers across the nation engaged in several short strikes and actions to protest attempts by Walmart to silence and retaliate against associates who spoke out about working conditions low pay, lack of respect, and other issues that plague workers at the notorious anti-union retail giant. Since then, workers say they have faced harassment and retaliation, including reduced hours and lost jobs. To highlight Walmart's continued effort to silence them, Walmart workers around the country will walk off their job on November 23rd on the biggest shopping day of the year, formerly known as Black Friday. But now with Walmart and other retailers opening their doors on Thanksgiving evening, it has morphed into Black Thursday. Last week, when Walmart announced that it would open its doors at 8 p.m. on Thanksgiving evening, Mary Pat Tift, who has worked at Walmart in Kenosha, Wisconsin for 24 years, and is one of the many workers scheduled to work during the Thanksgiving holiday, said, "I see the disappointment in the eyes of my coworkers, especially those with young kids who aren't going to be able to share the holiday with their families. The early opening is one more example of Walmart's disconnect with the workers who keep its store running in disregard for all of our families." In Seattle, where workers from several Walmart stores planned preview protests this Thursday, Benazi Luna told the Stand's David Groves, "My coworkers and I have been speaking out for change. Instead of Walmart working with us to improve conditions and customer service, Walmart has retaliated against us for speaking out. Without an end to the retaliation, Walmart workers across the country will be walking off the job on Black Friday. Join us in solidarity with our strike." Luna, like the other Walmart worker activists, is not a union member, but he and the activists have joined together in Our Walmart, a worker-led organization that stands up to make changes in its company. Find out more by going to makingchangeatwalmart.org or forrespect.org.
Probably
won't be open.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely wouldn't go there for
That's a crazy.
That's wrong, and it's wrong for the workers.
I think they should have that national holiday. It should be off.
Yeah.
If they want to open up at midnight after the holiday, that's bad enough. Why can't they just have the store closed on the national holiday? This doesn't seem right.
Yeah, it makes me sick. I don't know if anybody saw this. It was on the national news too, but Trump, the president of the AFL-CIO, met with Obama.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, and this is AFL-CIO Richard Trump, and other national leaders of the unions and progressive groups actively involved in discussions over fiscal priorities met with President Obama Tuesday morning at the White House. Trump and the group urged Obama to not give more tax cuts to those making more than $250,000 and to not cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. The group also pledged to support the president in fighting for a good deal for the country, even if that meant negotiating into a new year. Afterward, Trump told reporters, "We are very, very committed to making sure that the middle class and workers don't end up paying the tab for a party that we didn't get to go to, and the president is committed to that as well." He also said the union movement will remain mobilized throughout this lame duck session of Congress as lawmakers deal with ending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy and calls for by some, including a well-funded group of CEOs, corporate CEOs, called Fix the Debt for cuts in Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Benefits to pay for preserving tax cuts for the wealthy and increased corporate tax breaks as part of a so-called grand bargain on deficit. He said, "We're prepared to stand up to make sure there is shared sacrifice here so that the rich actually start paying their fair share and the class doesn't get soaked for that. And there's a petition to tell Congress that it is time to let the Bush tax cuts for the richest 2% expire. It protects Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid for benefit tax cuts.
Absolutely.
And the Associated Press reported that during Tuesday's meeting, participants said that the president reiterated his contention that the wealthy should pay more in taxes, and that his views were vindicated by the election.
Oh, absolutely. People were not too happy with that.
Hey, you know, when only like 2 or 3% of the country, less than 5%, make $250,000 or more a year.
Yeah.
Less than 5%. And it's freaking crazy that they shouldn't be paying a lot more, though. And they're getting taxed on the same rates as a guy making $40,000 or $30,000 or
$20,000. Yeah.
It's crazy. So anyway, he stands firm on taxes and issues of the tax of the wealthiest Americans, the near attendant, president of the Center of American Progress. Last week, a group of 146 union and progressive groups sent Obama a letter outlining of 5 key areas that must be included in any budget agreement. Want to read those?
Yeah, I'd be very interested in that.
Creating jobs and growing the economy.
Yeah, the 5 are. Creating jobs and growing the economy, including steps to spur private investment and to create targeted investments in infrastructure and education that will grow the economy and create quality jobs. Next, no cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security benefits, or shifting costs to beneficiaries or the state. Millions of seniors, children, and people with other disabilities and others depend on these vital programs, and they must not be cut. Next, no cuts to the safety net and the vital services for low-income people. We should not allow the fiscal burden to be shifted to poor and working families who have already borne a disproportionate share of the nation's economic pain in recent years. Next, stopping the sequester. We share the concern of economists, small business owners, state and local governments, and millions of individuals we represent that sequestration will harm our fragile recovery, will result in substantial loss of jobs in both the public and private sector, and will make harmful cuts in vital services needed to promote health, development, economic security for people and communities nationwide that have already sustained a $1.5 trillion in deficit reduction losses. Next, requiring the wealthiest and corporations to pay their fair share. Starting with ending tax cuts for the wealthiest 2%. While a wide range of programs have been cut in recent years, the very wealthy and corporations have so far not been required to contribute a penny in additional revenue toward deficit reduction. Securing substantial new revenue from those with the greatest ability to contribute will allow us to meet the deficit reduction goals, chart a more sustainable fiscal path forward, invest in the job creation measures our economy needs, and protect the programs and services that families depend on.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, that's what's going on there. And there's one thing I think question of, though, is that stopping the sequester. Now, the sequester actually is a sequester on military spending. All right?
Oh.
That's what that was supposed to be.
What that was.
The sequester was actually on military spending. Now, yeah, if they
what do they mean by that, the sequester of military spending?
Well, I mean stopping by, I think, some huge amount of money that will be cut out of the military budget.
Oh, really?
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of waste in that budget, no question about it. But the problem is that if you look at Connecticut,
we support our state with building
defense stuff.
Defense stuff.
You know, if you go into the sequester where you stop building a nuclear sub or you're
halfway through or something.
Yeah, supposedly there'll be major cuts in electric boat, Sikorsky aircraft,
Pratt & Whitney,
that kind of thing. But it's like so I can understand why they don't want the sequestering, but at the same time, you know, you got to cut somewhere, you know? And, damn, the military is probably the biggest waste if they could take the money that they save from the military and throw it into infrastructure, all those people would have jobs, okay?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all those people, all the welders and the electricians and the engineers and everybody else.
You've got a good point there.
We all have major jobs rebuilding this stuff. And, you know, we'd build a few less guns, you know what I mean, and nuclear...
Which couldn't hurt.
Right. So, I mean, that's where I think the transition should be. You know, but that's, of course, that's me talking and not Obama, you know. So, anyway, that's just more or less what I wanted to talk about here. There's one more article I wanted to talk about involving human issues. And then there's some very, very good articles that I wanted to touch on tonight.
Okay.
But this one here says, tell the lame duck Congress where voters want. Now, this was a, across the board, a majority of voters opposed cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid benefits, and to give millionaires and billionaires more tax breaks. Okay? But this is interesting. Because we know what millionaires want. Tell the lame duck Congress what voters want. 62% of voters support addressing the deficit by making the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes. 68% oppose raising the Medicare eligibility age. 69% oppose reducing Medicaid benefits. And 84% oppose reducing Social Security benefits. So, you know, that's quite staggering, really. That's a mandate.
Yeah, and that's not just Democrats, I'm sure.
No, I mean, that's a mandate. You know,
well, Obama said that Democrats voted for him for a lot of those reasons, and
yeah.
Republicans also support that.
But the problem that I have, and I really have this problem, is why Americans voted in the goddamn Republicans in the Congress.
I know.
After all the crap that they caused, they still voted these morons into office. And I said,
well, that's from some of those Western states.
It's really frightening to me. You know, what you're saying, what. No, but I mean, you states do the same thing.
Really? I'd have to look, and I can't answer that question because I have no idea why they would do that.
No, I know. But nobody does.
They probably don't even know why.
I don't think so. I just think it's. This is interesting here. You know, Hostess Twinkies.
Oh, yeah, I used to love those.
Yeah, nothing like those really good company. Hostess spreads misinformation on strike. This is a cross post from bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers. In a desperate attempt to break the solidarity and resolve the striking, BCTGM members across the country, Hostess Brands is falsely claiming that its decision to close three of its bakeries, St. Louis, Cincinnati, and Seattle, is the result of a nationwide strike against the company. In fact, according to the company's 1113 filing with the bankruptcy court earlier this year, as well as its last, best, final, non-negotiable proposal to its BCTGM representative workers, the company was planning to close at least 9 bakeries as part of its reorganization plan, although the company refused to disclose which bakeries it intended to close. This is in addition to the 3 bakeries that were to be closed as a result of the company's planned sale of its Merida division. Moreover, St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay was quoted in November. Lewis' article stated, I was told months ago they were planning to close the site in St. Louis, and there was no indication at that time it had anything to do with the strike the workers were waiting. And the article goes on. But over the past 8 years since the first Hostess bankruptcy, I didn't know they had filed before.
I didn't.
But, the members, the union members, have lost his money from previous concessions that was supposed to go toward capital investment, product development, plant improvement, new equipment was squandered in executive bonuses, payouts to Wall Street investors, and payments to high-priced attorneys and consultants. BCTGM members are well aware that as the company was preparing to file for bankruptcy earlier this year, the then CEO of Hostess was awarded a 300% raise from $750,000 to $2.55 million, and at least nine other top executives of the company received massive pay raises. Jeez, it's great, huh? You can go bankruptcy and give yourself a 50% pay raise.
Must be nice, huh?
More than 50%, 300% pay raise. One such executive received a pay raise from $500,000 to $900,000. Another received one taking his salary from $375,000 to $656,000. Over the past 15 months, Hostess workers have seen the company unilaterally end contractually obligated payments to their pension funds. Despite saving more than $160 million with this action, the company continues to fall deeper and deeper into debt. A mountain of debt and gross mismanagement by a string of failed CEOs with no true experience in the wholesale baking business have left this company unable to compete or survive. A total of 24 Hostess production facilities are on strike or honoring the strike with picket lines established by striking Hostess workers. Additionally, BCTGM members are one transport facility also are on strike. Company claims the union members are crossing picket lines and maintaining production at striking plants are vastly untrue.
Take a little music break.
I was just looking at the concession sheet here that they have. You can go to this. It's really interesting to see how they operate. But, I mean, a company that's going into bankruptcy, closing down places, is giving their CEOs, 300% raises.
Wow.
I mean, what's going on? We're going to go to a quick music break, and then we're going to come back and do some more fascinating stuff.
Right.
Thank you.
that.
Yeah. We got another article we want to read tonight.
Fiscal cliff air talk follows shock doctrine script. This is by Dave Johnson.
Right. This
that
is also a book that was written called Shock Doctrine, but nevertheless, Elena's going to read some of this because I think it's quite frightening that we are being frightened by this fiscal cliff when it's really a carpet crap.
At the end of the year, the Bush tax cuts expire. When this happens, tax rates will rise modestly to where they were when Clinton was president. Also, at the end of the year, budget sequestration occurs. This means that the various cuts Congress approved to the end, the debt ceiling crisis will begin to phase in. Remember, the debt ceiling crisis was what Republicans refused to allow the country to honor its debt, holding the economy hostage until they got beat. Budget cuts and the things we the people do for each other. That's it. That's the crisis. All the people who had been hysterical about budget crisis are now hysterical that taxes will go up and spending will go down. Go figure. Maybe, just maybe, I shouldn't even say it, these serious people weren't serious when they were said they were worried about the deficit. You see, the budget cuts, cutting the deficit, is military spending. Unfortunately, the sequestration also cuts important things that help a lot of people in our economy, but these cuts do not take place all at once. They will be phased in over time. Congress can act any time to halt any of these cuts. The fiscal cliff is not a cliff, and the language itself is intended to scare people. The name itself is designed to create panic, evoking disaster imagery of people in the economy kicking off and falling off a cliff. It is the latest manufactured crisis, and we're supposed to be terrified and demand immediate and extreme solutions. Again, the very people screaming loudest about deficits are the people who passed tax cut after tax cut and military spending increase after military spending increase and started war after, and these are the same people that voted for military spending increases and started war after war. Then these same serious people terrified the public, telling them that budget deficits would lead to the destruction of the country. And soon, after a decade of screaming 9/11, 9/11, noun verb, 9/11, they scream deficit, deficit, deficit. Now they scream fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff. Then after the public is suitably stirred up and terrified, they offer the solution they say are necessary to cut the scary deficit. And the fixing has to happen right now. The lame duck Congress before these new legislators, we the people elected, can take office. And the grand bargain. That's what you hear them talking about all the time, the grand bargain.
The grand bargain. The serious people are pushing for a grand bargain. That, they say, will solve the deficit problem once and for all. Of course, nothing in any grand bargain can bind Congress. And any part of this grand bargain can and will be undone by Congress at the earliest opportunity. The outline of this bargain involves tax reform and getting a handle on entitlements. Tax reform does not involve raising tax rates on the wealthy. It reforms taxes by getting rid of various deductions and lowering tax rates. Getting a handle on entitlements means cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, food stamps, and the rest of the things that we, the people, do for each other, the things we are entitled to as citizens in a democracy. Right? And no, Social Security by law cannot and does not contribute to the deficit. They just threw it in because it's in crisis. Social Security crisis is that under certain economic projections, its funding might run a bit short many years down the road. Compare this possible future shortfall to the huge, vast, bloated, enormous military budget, which, unlike Social Security, has no separate funding mechanism and runs 100% short every year. But that is not a crisis. Fix for a budget problem caused by cutting taxes, massively increasing military spending, and crashing the economy will be solved by not fixing those things. Once again, the income and wealth of the country will be shifted away from we the people and upward to the same 1% who have been benefiting from everything in our economy since the election of Ronald Reagan and the disaster capitalism plummeted, cut taxes, raised military spending, and used the resulting deficits to scare people into accepting extreme solutions. Rinse and repeat. The Shock Doctrine. The Shock Doctrine is a book by Naomi Klein that describes a disaster capitalism strategy used by wealthy and powerful people to take advantage of crisis, even causing crisis to herd people into accepting solutions to those crises that really just enrich the 1% at the expense of the rest of us.
Yeah.
In times of crisis, real or perceived, the public is in a state of shock, distracted and ready to grasp at straws to get out of the panic. This is the perfect time for serious people to come in and offer pre-planned solutions. These solutions usually involve privatizing public institutions and wealth, cutting public services, cutting taxes on the rich, seizing property, lowering wages and pensions. Well, just look at Europe's austerity and you'll get the picture. This Shock Doctrine disaster capitalism model has become standard practice. We see this happening all over and over again. When crises occur or are manufactured, the media whips people into a panic, and then the solution is introduced. This is problem, reaction, solution. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
A solution involves a reform that transfers wealth and institutions into a few private hands. The real problem and the real solution. We have a jobs problem, not a deficit problem. The best way to deal with a deficit is to put Americans back to work. The real job creators are working people with money in their wallets. We can't cut our way to growth. These are not just slogans. These are solutions to real problems. We need to invest in our economy, restoring and modernizing our infrastructure, retrofitting our homes and buildings to be more energy efficient, upgrading our public schools and universities, and fighting to create the manufacturing ecosystems for the new industries of the future. All of these investments create jobs while they are underway and paid off by improving our economy for the long term. Inoculate yourself by reading the Shock Doctrine. Inoculate your friends by telling them about the book and how this game works over and over again. That's what's happening to us, folks. I mean, it's not fun. We're getting screwed. GMO verified products. Want to read some of these products? I think it was important when I saw it. We encourage you to support the brands and products below in a recognition of their laudable commitment to ensure the sustained availability of non-GMO options and their belief that consumers deserve an informed choice. And the following are the different companies. Verified products. So hang on a second here.
There'll be quite a few of them.
Yeah. Alternative dairy products. dairy products. Following brands have one or more products that have been verified by the non-GMO project. 365 everyday value. Organic flax milk, original. Organic flax milk, vanilla. Organic rice milk, original. Organic rice milk, unsweetened. Organic rice milk, vanilla. Blue Diamond almonds. Almond breeze, coconut, almost like, you know, almost all their products. Raw coconut, see, coconut secret, Earth Balance, Eden, soy products that we have. Follow Your Heart, Good Karma, Good Growing Naturals, Melt, coconut bliss, Native Forestry, Organic Valley, Pacific Melt, some basil, Silk, which make all the soy beverages. So Delicious, dairy free. We got a million products here. Okay, you want to read some of these? Just go by there.
Sensitive, you touch it and it.
Yeah. Started Wayfair. You can just read some of these. West.
Oh, these are some of the.
Yeah, and just a couple of their products. Yeah. You know, these are all non-GMO products.
Wayfair, but they make butterscotch pudding, cheddar style dip sauce, cheddar style spread. West, they make low fat plain soy meal drink, plain low fat soy meal drink, rice beverages. Mostly soy milk and soy milk drinks.
If you see any of these companies, they will just go because there's a ton of categories. And we'll go back and read a couple of them. But it's fine.
And then the Whole Soy and Company, obviously, that makes soy stuff. True Whip, the natural whip, I don't know what that is. It must be like whipped cream. Almond Dream, Dream Blend, Galaxy Nutritional Foods. Maury New, Nancy's, Purely Decadent, Rice Cream, Soy Dream, Soy Cast, and Temp.
And what I wanted to do is get back to the
article.
And you might want to, and for very important beverages, body care, bread and baked goods, candy, sweeteners, there are all kinds of stuff here. The non-GMO project. Go to that non-GMO project. Okay, you might want to bookmark that. Okay, on your computer because the non. GMO milks and shoots. forget about this, just GMO myths and truths.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of myths out there propagated by the industry, okay, about GMOs.
You know, everybody in the world couldn't be wrong, and we're right. Since there's no long-term testing on any of this.
We have been right, and the world's been wrong many times on this show.
Well, I mean, in Europe and all kinds of places, they refuse to have GMO food.
GMO myths and truths. An evidence-based examination of the claims made for the safety and efficacy of genetically modified crops. This is great because this is like almost a book that
really?
You can, yeah.
Download?
Book that you can download. You know, it's right on the site. You can see it. And genetic engineering is just an extension of natural breeding. It's a myth. True. Genetic engineering is different from natural breeding and poses special risks. Muddying the waters with imprecise terms. How does genetic modification create mutations? Is GM technology becoming more precise? Why worry about mutations caused in genetic engineering? These are just five some of the titles of these chapters.
Worthwhile reading.
Really, it's about 122 pages. The executive summary states here that the genetically modified GM crops are promoted on the basis of range of far-reaching claims from the GM crop industry and its supporters. They say the GM crops are an extension of natural breeding and do not pose different risks from the naturally bred crops. They say they are safe to eat and can be more nutritious than naturally bred crops, are strictly regulated for safety, increased crops yield, reduce pesticide use. This is bullshit. All of this stuff is bullshit. Benefit farmers and make their lives easier. Bring economic benefit the environment. Can't help solve problems. Can help solve problems caused by climate change. Reduce energy use and will help feed the world. That is crap. But these are what are the realities. However, a large and growing body of scientific and other authoritative evidence show that these claims are not true. On the contrary, evidence presented in this report indicates that GM crops are laboratory-made using technology that is totally different from natural breeding methods and poses different risks for non-GM crops. Can be toxic, allergenic, or less nutritious than
well, we've read some articles about how some of it is toxic.
Sure. Are not adequately regulated to ensure safety, do not increase yield potential, do not reduce pesticide use, but increase it, create serious problems for farmers, including herbicide tolerance, super weeds, compromised soil quality, and increased disease susceptibility in crops, have mixed economic effects, harm soil quality, disrupt ecosystems, and reduce biodiversity, do not offer effective solutions to climate change, and are as energy hungry as any other chemically farmed crops, cannot solve the problem of the world hunger, but distract from its real causes, poverty, lack of access to food, and increasingly lack of access to land to grow it on.
That's going to be the next problem, I think.
Based on the evidence presented in this report, there is no need to take risks with GM crops when effective, readily available, and sustainable solutions to problems that GM technologies claim to address already exist. Conventional plant breeding, in some cases helped by safe, modern technology like gene mapping and market-assisted selection, continue to outperform GM genetic modification and producing high-yield, drought-tolerant, and pest and disease-resistant crops that can meet our present and future needs. And it goes on, and it goes on and on and tells you, you know, and
trumps all of the claims that are made by the GMO companies. And a very, very good article, very good place. Bill, and it's called Natural GMO and Truth. But what the website was. The Non-GMO Project. Non-GMO Project. Hmm. That is pretty cool. Fine non-GMO. Verified restaurants.
Oh, I mean restaurants that serve non-GMO.
Verified restaurants.
Are you going to be doing some esoteric knowledge.
Some
or?
Esoteric things I will be doing with a series that I'm working on. Right, so please stay tuned, and we will talk to you next tomorrow night.
Yeah, good night, folks.
Good
Have a good
everybody.
Evening.
Yeah.
Not too much left to it.
Good night, everybody. Like my song.